You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Man's Life on Earth and in the Spiritual Worlds, given in England in 1922. This is Lecture 3, given in London on the 30th of August. When one can be so seldom together, one would like to compress as much as possible into a lecture. Indeed, the temptation is to put too much into it. In spite of this, I am going to try today to describe from a certain point of view what we may call the other side of human existence on the earth. And I should like to connect this with certain deeper knowledge, certain spiritual knowledge, and its significance for our age. When all is said and done, how much does man know about his existence when his knowledge has been acquired only by the use of his senses and the intellect bound to them? With the ordinary sense consciousness, we pass through the waking part of human existence only. And yet it is really not for nothing that the spiritual powers guiding the world have woven the sleeping state into man's existence. A very great deal happens to man from the time when he falls asleep until he wakes up. Indeed, by far the most of what the spirit has to accomplish through man in earthly existence comes to pass during the sleeping condition. During the waking state, there is accomplished only what man is working at in connection with himself and with the external world. During the sleeping state, the purposes of higher spiritual beings in connection with human evolution and the soul of man are carried out, in order that the collective development of man in earth existence may go forward. We must not forget that although modern initiation science is able to look with greater precision into what happens to man between sleeping and waking, yet these things do not happen only to those who are initiated, but to all men. Indeed, man's evolution depends upon them. The initiate can only draw attention to them, and more men must feel and perceive their significance. Men, that is to say, who reflect upon the meaning of this earth existence. Today I should like to describe to you quite simply what comes into play during man's sleeping state. You know that an external description of falling asleep may be given thus. Man's astral body and ego detach themselves from his physical and etheric bodies. This ego and astral body are then in the spiritual world, and do not permeate the physical and etheric bodies as they do from waking till going to sleep. But if we look at what really happens to man during his sleep condition, we find that we must return to the consideration of how he is connected with the earth during waking life. In the first place, he is connected with the earth through his senses, inasmuch as he perceives and cognizes through them the phenomena of the different kingdoms of nature. He is further connected with the earth, however, inasmuch as during waking life his unconscious functions come into play. He carries on his breathing, for example, and into the air of the breath the whole earth enters. Innumerable substances in a very subtle and refined condition are present in the air that man breathes. But just because they are in this very subtle condition, their effect is extraordinarily significant when, through the air that is breathed, they are taken up into the human organism. Just in the same way as what a man perceives through his senses enters him consciously, so there enters unconsciously, during his waking life, much that is of a nature more material than what enters through the abstract conceptual state of perception and thinking. In a more material sense, the surrounding world enters into man through the breath. And when you take into consideration in what high degree the human organization is dependent on all that it takes into itself in the different food substances of the earth, you will realize that a great deal is working upon man in his waking state. That, however, is of less immediate interest to us today. What we are considering today is what works upon man in his sleeping state. Just as the external substances, the earth element, are connected with man during his waking state, so when he passes over to the sleeping state, he enters into a certain connection with the whole cosmos. This is not to be understood to mean that man, with his astral body, embraces the magnitude of the cosmos every night. Such a statement would be an exaggeration. Man, however, does grow into the cosmos every night. Just as here we are connected with the plants, minerals, and the air, so during the night we are connected with the movements of the stars and planets and with the constellations of the fixed stars. From the time of going to sleep until we wake up, the world of the stars is our world, just as the earth is our world in waking life. The first thing to bear in mind is that we can distinguish different spheres through which we pass between the time of going to sleep and of waking. The first sphere is that wherein the human ego and astral body, that is to say the human soul as it exists in sleep, the human soul then, feels itself to be connected with the movements of the planetary world. Just as we should say when we wake in the morning and return to our physical body, quote, "We have within us our lungs, heart, liver, brain," close quote. So, speaking of the sleeping state, we should say, quote, "In the first sphere that we enter directly after falling asleep, and again just before waking up, we have within us the forces of the planetary movements," close quote. It is not as though every night we took up within us the whole movement of the planets, but what we bear within us as a reflection is, in point of fact, a minute picture in which the movements of the planets are faithfully reflected. It is different in each man. We may put it thus. When a man first goes to sleep, he experiences the planetary movements in such a way that he has a reflection in a kind of planetary globe. He has a reflection in a kind of planetary globe in his astral body of what is going on in universal space between the planets as they move. This is man's first experience after he falls asleep. Let me read that again. We may put it thus. When a man first goes to sleep, he experiences the planetary movements in such a way that he has a reflection in a kind of planetary globe in his astral body of what is going on in universal space between the planets as they move. This is man's first experience after he falls asleep. Now, you must not say, quote, "I have no concern with all this, or I am not conscious of it at all," close quote. True, you do not see it with your eyes or hear it with your ears. But in the moment of your passing over into the sleep state, the portion of your astral body that during waking life is incorporated in the heart becomes a heart eye, EYE, and is able to see what is going on in this way. This heart eye is actually aware of what is there experienced, even although it is true that the consciousness of it in man of the present day is very dim. This heart eye is conscious of what is experienced during the first period of time, after going to sleep in such a way that it looks back to the man who, as physical and etheric body, is lying in bed. The ego and astral body look back with the heart eye. And what is then inwardly experienced as the reflection of the planetary movements in the body, streams back again from our own etheric body, so that we see the reflected picture from our own etheric body. The present constitution of men is such that when they wake, they immediately forget the dim consciousness which they have had in the night through their heart eye. It is a dim consciousness, and there is no more than an echo of it in dreams, which, although possessing something of planetary movement in their inner mobility, contain pictures from life. These pictures from life insert themselves into the dreams that are subject to the movements of the planets. The pictures enter because the astral body dips down into the etheric body, and the etheric body preserves the memories of life. It may be that you wake up in the morning, having returned through the sphere of the planetary movements. Let us say that you have experienced therein, parenthesis, because it is specially connected with your destiny or your karma, close parenthesis, a certain relationship between Jupiter and Venus. This may be. You may have experienced a certain relationship between Jupiter and Venus. If you were to take up into waking life what you there experienced between Jupiter and Venus, a great deal that is connected with your human faculties would become clear to you, for your faculties proceed from the cosmos, not from the earth. Your gifts and talents are fashioned according to the way in which you are related to the cosmos, and according to this also are you good or inclined at least toward the good or toward the evil. You would see what intercourse has taken place between Jupiter and Venus. You would have perceived this with your heart eye, or I might as well say with your heart ear, for one cannot precisely distinguish the consciousness in that sphere. Beside the fact that there is only very dim consciousness of what has occurred, it is forgotten. But into this intercourse between Jupiter and Venus, which is being carried on in a reciprocal movement in your astral body, there enters what you experienced, let us say, at midday when you were 17 or 25 years old, perhaps in Oxford or Manchester or somewhere else. Pictures enter into and mingle with the cosmic experiences. Hence the pictures and images in dreams have a certain significance, but they are not the element of greatest importance. They are the garment, as it were, which is woven over the cosmic experiences. The experience arising through this heart consciousness is associated with a certain feeling of alarm. In the case of nearly everybody, certain sensations of alarm are associated with this experience. Especially is this the case when, from the human etheric body of man, there radiates and sounds back the cosmic experiences. For instance, when that which has been brought back from the etheric body in such a way that a ray full of significance for your heart consciousness comes back from the human head, and another ray from the region under the heart blends its sound and its light therewith, then there originates this alarm for the heart consciousness. Because of this alarm, the soul that is not absolutely mature actually feels in sleep that the world mist has taken possession of it. The feeling is as though we become as thin as the world mist, as though we were floating like a cloud of world mist within it. This is an actual experience after we first fall asleep. And then, from this feeling of alarm, and this experience of being part of the world mist, within the world mist, there comes a feeling of surrender to the Godhead brooding over the world. These are the two basic experiences that come to man in the first sphere, through which he passes after falling asleep. Quote, I am in the world mist, and I would fain rest in the bosom of the Godhead in order to be made secure against dissolution into this world mist. Close quote. The heart consciousness must carry this over to the morning, when man once more dips down with his soul into his physical and etheric bodies. For if this experience were not taken over into life, all the substances taken in by man through the following day as food, or which would otherwise be worked into him through digestion, and if he is hungry, when the substances would be taken from his own body, all these substances would take on their wholly earthly character, and the whole human organism would be brought into disorder. The importance of sleep for waking life is very great indeed. In the present state of the earth's evolution, man is not yet able to provide for the carrying over of the divine into waking life. For as men of the present age are constituted, it is hardly possible for them to generate power sufficient to bring these things in full consciousness from the other side of existence to this. When he has experienced this, man comes to the next sphere, but he does not lose the first experience. That remains in his heart consciousness. The next sphere is much more complicated, and a man becomes aware of it with that part of his astral body which, during the day, in his waking life, is embodied in the human solar plexus, embodied as well in his whole limb organization. It is the solar plexus, limb organization, that part of the astral body that permeates the solar plexus and the arms and legs, that during the night becomes aware of what is to be found in the next sphere. In the next sphere, man feels in his astral body the forces which come from the zodiacal signs. One kind of forces comes direct from the zodiac, and the others are zodiacal forces that have passed through the earth, according to whether the zodiacal signs are above or under the earth. That makes the great difference. Man then becomes aware of his whole relationship with the zodiac, and with the planetary movements through what I will call his sun consciousness, his sun eye, EYE. Because what is consciousness is the portion of the astral body that is connected with the solar plexus and the limb organization. The picture then widens out. Man grows into a kind of picture of the cosmos. Again, this is reflected back to man from his physical and etheric bodies, at which he looks back. So that every night man enters into a sphere where what proceeds from his body comes into connection with the whole cosmos, with planetary movements, and with the constellations of the fixed stars. The experience of the fixed stars is such that man feels himself within all the 12 fixed stars. This experience may arise in one man half an hour after falling asleep, with another after a much longer period, and another after quite a short time. The experiences in the sphere of the fixed stars are exceedingly complicated. I think you might have traveled to all the most important regions of the earth, and you would not have the mass of experiences which your sun eye enters into every night in one single zodiacal constellation, for they then still had within them strong forces of dreamy clairvoyance, and were conscious in a kind of dreamlike way of what I am now describing. Today it is hardly possible for a man to acquire clear consciousness with his sun eye, but he must learn to acquire it. Even by day he has forgotten it. Today it is hardly possible for man to acquire full consciousness of what he experiences during the night in this 12-fold complicated sense, if he has not received into his soul what it was Christ's will to become in the earth through the mystery of Golgotha. To have formed thoughts during ordinary earth life about the Christ brings into the astral body, by the detour of the physical and etheric body, a certain essence, so that Christ becomes the leader in the zodiac from the time of going to sleep till the time of waking up. Man actually feels, quote, "Am I then to be swallowed up in the multitudes of the stars and the happenings in their sphere?" Close quote. And when a man can look back to the thoughts, conceptions, feelings, and will impulses which he has directed to the Christ, Christ becomes his leader, bringing order into the confused happenings of this sphere. So we must say, on the other side of life there is to be found for the first time the full significance of Christ since the mystery of Golgotha for the earth life of humanity. And it is true that nobody in the ordinary civilization of today understands what Christ must yet become for earth life. There is so much misinterpretation of experiences which in our days are passed through by only very few men. The chaotic way in which men, as yet unrelated to the Christ event, bring their night experiences into waking day consciousness can only be understood if there is knowledge of what I have just brought forward. When we have passed through this nebulous existence in sleep, we confront a world of confusion, a world in which the Christ appears like a spiritual sun and becomes our leader in such a way that the confusion resolves itself into a kind of harmonious understanding. This is important because at the moment when we enter this sphere where the fixed star constellations of the zodiac and the movements of the planets whirl in and out of each other, our karma actually comes before our sun-eye. All men are aware of their karma, but only in the sleeping state. In the waking state, it is only the reflection of this consciousness that steals in as a kind of feeling. Much of what a man who is striving for self-knowledge may meet within himself is a very dim echo of this experience. When the Christ appears as the leader through Aries, Taurus, Gemini, and so on, and illuminates the universe for men during the night, so that they again gather strength for their day life. What we experience in this sphere is nothing less than that Christ becomes our leader through the confusing events of the zodiac, stands there as the being who guides men from constellation to constellation, in order that he can take up coordinated forces into himself, forces which he needs for waking life. Man, as spirit and soul, experiences this every night between sleeping and waking, as a result of his relationship with the cosmos. Just as he is related to the earth in physical body and etheric body, so is he related to the cosmos in his soul and spirit and astral body. When man has detached himself from his physical and etheric bodies, and has, in this way, grown out into the cosmic world, he would feel in himself a strong tendency to grow out beyond the zodiac, in an inner picture experience, streaming back to him from that part of his being that has remained lying in bed. That he cannot at first do between birth and death, because another element enters during sleep into all the experiences which I have described for you, a moon element that is of quite a different kind from what comes from the planets and fixed stars. The moon element somewhat tinges the whole cosmos during the night, even when it is new moon, with something that a man experiences. But he experiences it in such a way that this moon element, these moon forces, hold him back within the world of the zodiac and lead him back to waking life. The experience of this moon element is only faint, weak in the first sphere. During the second sphere that I have described, man experiences the mysteries of birth and death especially strongly. His organ of experience there lies still deeper than the heart eye and the sun eye. It is an organ that is distributed in a certain degree over his whole being. And he experiences every night how the spiritual and soul being has descended out of the world of soul and spirit, entering through birth into a physical existence, and how the body gradually passes over to death. Man really dies every moment, but overcomes death until death actually sets in as a single experience. In that moment when man experiences how the soul passes through earthly bodily existence, he experiences through the same forces his connection with the rest of humanity. It is important to realize that not even the most insignificant event, the most insignificant circumstance, any more than the most portentous, is without connection with the collective destiny and karma of man. Souls to whom we were related in past earth lives, or to whom we are related in this, whether they are for a time in the spiritual worlds or are here on earth, all men's affairs with men, human relationships which have an inner connection to the mystery of birth and death, all come before his spiritual human eye, EYE. Man feels himself to be within his whole life destiny. This is connected with the fact that all other forces, namely those of the planets and those of the fixed stars, tend to draw us out into the cosmos. The tendency of the moon is to place us again within the world of men. The moon tears us out of the cosmos. The forces of the moon are set in opposition to the forces of the sun and the forces of the stars. The moon determines our relationship to the earth. Hence, the moon brings us, in a certain sense, every night, back from the zodiacal experiences to the planetary experiences, and finally, to the earth experiences, inasmuch as we are brought back into the physical human body. The difference between sleep and death, considered from a certain point of view, is this: that man, when he sleeps, maintains a firm relationship to the moon forces. These moon forces direct him every night, anew, to the meaning of his earth life. But this can only be the case because there streams back to man, from his etheric body, all that I have described. In death, the etheric body is drawn out of man's physical body. The reversed memory of the last earth life comes about, and now it is this etheric body which, for a short period of some days, permeates the cloud of which I have spoken. I said that every night we ourselves live as a cloud of mist, in a world of mist. But this cloud of mist, which we ourselves are, is during the night separated from our etheric body. When we die, the etheric body is there during the first days after death. Then the etheric body gradually dissolves into the cosmos. The memory vanishes. And now we have, in contradistinction to what was there earlier, when all our star experiences were what had streamed back from the man lying in bed, now, after death, we have a direct inner experience of the planetary movements and the constellations of the fixed stars. If you read my book titled Theosophy, you will find there a description of the experiences from a certain point of view. But what a man has between death and a new birth is in that book described as if it were around him. But just as you would not see colors if an eye did not exist within the body, just as you could not breathe if you had no lungs and heart, so, after death, you would not be able to be aware of what I have described as the soul and spirit lands, as your environment in the spiritual world, if you had not within you Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, etc. That is then your organism. You experience that with your cosmic organism. The moon can no longer bring you back, because the moon can only bring you back to your etheric body. And the etheric body has dissolved into the cosmos. But there exists in man so much of that force which the moon has bequeathed to him, that he does remain for a time in the soul world, as I have described it in Theosophy. His gaze is still directed toward the earth. Then he passes over into what I have described as the spirit land, and he feels himself to be living outside and beyond the zodiac and the universe of the fixed stars. This is what he experiences in the time between death and a new birth. Perhaps I may describe the details of this process of growing into the spiritual world somewhat as follows, but you must naturally not press these concepts, for one really cannot express these things in earthly concepts. Let me try to describe it to you as follows. Think of flowers in a meadow, and imagine that from each blossom, and from such blossoms as grow on trees, there proceeds a kind of spiral line which ascends out into the universe. These spiral lines contain the forces by means of which the cosmos directs and brings about the plant growth of the earth. For the plants do not merely grow out of their seed. They grow as the result of the cosmic, spiral-like forces surrounding the earth. These forces are, of course, there in winter and in the desert, even where no plants are present. In order to enter into the planetary movements, man must use these plant spiral forces every night as his guide. He ascends into the movements of the planetary world by the guidance of the plant spiral forces, and by the power which causes the plants to grow upward from their root. The plants must indeed use some kind of power in order to be able to grow upward. By this power, man is brought into the second sphere that I have described. I have already described experiences where man falls into a certain state of alarm and says to himself, quote, I am a creature of mist in the universal world mist, and I must rest in the bosom of the Godhead, close quote. Considering that in relation to earth conditions, this is what the soul feels, quote, I rest in all that broods as cosmic blessing over a cornfield when it comes to fruition, over the meadows when they blossom, close quote. All that which sinks down to the plants in spiral lines of force, all that is, fundamentally speaking, the bosom of the Godhead, the moving, living bosom of divinity, in which a man feels himself to be during sleep. It is the moon that leads him back again to his animal nature. The plant forces only strive to carry man further and further out into the universe. But since man has his animal nature in common with the animals, the moon brings him back every morning to his animal nature. Such, then, is man's connection with the cosmos. This is how the cosmos works between the time of falling asleep and of waking up. And with the heart eye, sun eye, or human eye, a man may perhaps experience in the night a certain relationship to another man, but it is not told to him in the ordinary sense, nor does he think it out. It is told to him by the language of the plants, through which he is guided out into the planetary world, and then impelled out into the world of the zodiac. Such an experience may be expressed as follows. I have a relationship to such and such a man. The lilies tell it to me. The roses tell it to me. For the rose forces, the lily forces, the tulip forces have impelled me to it. The whole earth, as it were, a book of life, explanatory of the human soul into which a man grows. Read that sentence again, I'm going to add a word. The whole earth is, as it were, a book of life, explanatory of the human soul world into which a man grows. Men belonging to the various epochs and ages have had these experiences in different ways, of course. If we look back to the ancient Indians, we shall see that those who wished to experience something in the sleeping state as the result of their relationship to the world of the stars wished only to experience those fixed stars and constellations which are above the earth for a time. Of course, such constellations are not above the earth always, but only for a time. The ancient Indians had no wish to enter into relationships to those constellations which are under the earth and whose forces pass through the earth. In this connection, let us consider the posture of a Buddha, or that of an oriental sage endeavoring through certain exercises to attain to spiritual wisdom. The legs are crossed over each other, and he sits above the crossed legs because he wishes to have only his upper body active, and that which is related to the upper constellations, and not that which worked through him through the sun eye and through the limbs. His aim was to eliminate the limb forces. Hence you can see by the posture of an Oriental who strives for wisdom that his only aim is to bring about a relationship to what is above the earth. He wants only to develop cognitional relationship toward what is of the soul. The world would have been incomplete if this way of striving for knowledge had been the only one, if only Buddhistic postures had been adopted when it was a question of attaining to knowledge. Even within the Greek epoch, it was necessary for man to enter into relationship with the forces that proceed from contact with those constellations which are for a time under the earth. This is hinted at in a marvelous way in the Greek legends, which always tell of a certain kind of initiation. A man descends into the underworld. We may always recognize that certain Greek heroes are passing through initiation when it is said that they descended into the underworld. For this means to say that they had come to know those forces of the cosmos which work through the earth, the Thonian forces. Each epoch, then, has its special task. And the knowledge of the Oriental initiate was such that he could instruct other men about what lay before birth or conception, could teach them about the soul and spiritual regions through which a man passes before he descends to the earth. And the essence of all that in such a marvelous way streams to mankind in the Oriental world conception, and in Oriental poetry lies in the fact that in those early times men were able to look into the life through which a human being passes before he descends to the earth. In Greece, man began to have knowledge of what is dependent upon the earth itself. Uranus and Gaia, Gaia the earth, stand at the beginning of Greek cosmology. And it was the constant aspiration of the Greek to acquire knowledge of the mysteries of the earth itself, mysteries which are, of course, cosmic too, but working through the earth itself. It was for knowledge of the mysteries of the real underworld that the Greeks strove, and so there developed in Greece a real cosmology. Just consider how little the Greek really possessed, and the Oriental had none at all, of what we call historical cognition. He was much more interested in what was there when the earth was evolved in the cosmos, when the inner forces of the earth, the titanic forces, fought against other forces, which the Greek saw as mighty spiritual powers underlying the earth conditions into which man is woven. It is our task in this modern age to understand history and to be able to show that man has emerged from an ancient dreamlike condition of clairvoyance, that he has now come to a consciousness colored with intellectuality, and only faintly tinged by the mythical element. Out of this he again has to emerge to perception of the spiritual world. Our present epoch is indeed the transition to conscious attainment of experiences in the spiritual world. To this end we must, above all things, turn our attention to history. Hence, in our anthroposophical movement, we have over and over again followed up different epochs of history, back to the time when men still received their knowledge from higher beings, and from there right up to our own age. This historical evolution of mankind has always been considered. Modern external knowledge looks upon this historical evolution of mankind in a way that is quite abstract. Just think of the abstractions that are given when it is a question of tracing historical knowledge today. Men of ancient times described history by clothing it in myths, bringing it into connection with the whole of nature and the happenings of nature. We are no longer able to do that. Neither have men developed the sense that will make them ask about the conditions under which primeval man received wisdom from higher beings, and how this gradually grew dim. Neither do they ask how it was that a god himself descended to incarnation in a human body in order to pass through the mystery of Golgotha and fulfill a cosmic mission on the earth which should give the earth its meaning. The whole theology of the 19th and 20th centuries suffers from the fact that it cannot understand Christ in his spiritual significance. And that is what modern initiation science must bring. There must be a modern initiation science able again to penetrate into the spiritual worlds and speak of birth and death, of life between birth and death, and between death and a new birth, and of the life of the human soul in sleep, as has been done today. It must become possible for man again to learn about this spiritual side of existence. Indeed, human progress in the future will go forward only if man gains knowledge of this other side of existence. At one time, men directed their knowledge to the upper worlds only. This has already been indicated by consideration of the posture of a Buddha. Later on, men who were initiated in the Greek Thonic mysteries read their cosmology from the earth evolution. This is narrated in the Greek myths in a most wonderful way. After men have studied, as was the case in Greece, the secrets of the heavens and the earth in their science of initiation, what is needed is a modern initiation science which can rhythmically move between heaven and earth, which asks the heavens when it would gain knowledge of the earth, and the earth when it would gain knowledge of the heavens. These are the questions that are asked, I say this in all humility, and answered in my book titled An Outline of Occult Science, also entitled now An Outline of Esoteric Science, aside. That book tries to describe what modern man needs. Just as the ancient Oriental felt the need of the mysteries of the heavens, and the Greek felt the mysteries of the earth, it is necessary in the present age to realize the conditions of modern initiation and its relation to man. In order briefly to characterize the tasks fundamental to modern initiation, let me repeat something that I said in Oxford a few days ago, which some of you will have heard. I want first to point out that for the oldest initiates, the essential thing was their gaze upward to the spiritual worlds, out of which man descends when he clothes himself with an earth body. For the later initiates, the essential thing was what I tried to characterize by pointing you to the Greek representation of the descent into the underworld. And it is the task of the modern initiate to seek for the knowledge of the rhythmical relationship to the heavens, to the earth. That will only be attained when man himself is held within our vision, that is to say, held within the heart vision, sun vision, man vision. The heavens must be known, the earth must be known, of course, but it is in man that heaven and earth work together in unity. There are many more mysteries in man than are to be perceived by the outer senses or explained by the intellect bound to the senses. The task of modern initiation science is to know man in a spiritual sense. Initiation science has to acquire all-embracing knowledge, for man must be understood in the light of the whole world, the whole cosmos. Compare the position of the initiate of the present day with that of the initiate of ancient times. The soul faculties of ancient man made possible the awakening of memory of the time before he descended into the physical body. Hence, for the ancient initiates, it was a question of an awakening of cosmic memories. For the Greeks, it was a question of looking into nature. The modern initiate has to acquire direct knowledge of man as a spiritual being. He, then, must develop the capacity to detach his knowledge of man from what brings man into connection with the world. And here I will again bring before you something that I mentioned recently. One of the most difficult tasks of initiation knowledge is to establish a connection with souls who have left the earth either a short or long time ago, souls who have passed through the gate of death. It is possible, nevertheless, by the awakening of deeper soul forces, to establish such a connection. We must, however, here be perfectly clear that the first thing to do is to make ourselves familiar through exercises with the language in which we have to speak with the dead. This language is, in a certain sense, an offspring of human speech. But it would be absolutely incorrect to imagine that our human speech would help us to establish intercourse with the dead. The first thing to realize is that the dead, for a very short time only, understand what lies in the nouns and substantives of earthly language. That which expresses a thing, a separate thing, defined by a noun, no longer exists in the language of the dead. In the language of the dead, everything is related to activity, to inner movement. Hence we find that when a certain period of time has elapsed after their death, men have real perception only for verbs, for words that express action, movement. To have intercourse with the dead, we must always formulate our questions in such a way that they are intelligible to them. Then, if we understand how to listen properly, the answer comes after a time. As a rule, several nights have to pass before the dead can answer the questions which we put to him. But as has already been said, we must find our way into the language of the dead. Ultimately, we shall discover the language that is really native to the dead, a language that the dead himself has to find, because his whole soul life has to pass away from the earth. We find our way to a language that is not fashioned in any sense in accordance with earth conditions, a kind of heart language based upon feeling, proceeding from the heart. The language is fashioned somewhat in the way that interjections in human speech are formed when we say, "Ah," if we are astonished or amazed, or "I," when we are referring to ourselves. It is in this way that the sounds and the configuration of the sounds get their real meaning. And at this point, speech passes over into something that is no longer mere organic sound. It is transformed into something like that which rises out of the flowers, giving us information about men. And we ourselves begin to speak with that which comes out of the flowers. We ourselves become flowers, as it were, and we blossom with the flowers. And by giving ourselves and soul forces over to the tulip flower, we express in the imagination of the tulip that which on the earth is expressed in the formation of the word. Once again, we grow into the spiritual element of all things. The body of man itself will become something quite different. It will become a world in itself to us when we grow into initiation science, as it has been described. Read the literature about it. Whereas the ancient initiate had to reawaken a faculty that had been lost to man, had to bring to memory man's existence as it was before he descended to the earth, the initiate of the present has to accomplish something quite new, that is, an advance, something that will have meaning when man himself will have left the earth. Yes, even when the earth will be there, no longer in the cosmos. That is the task of modern initiation science. And out of this force and power must modern initiation science speak. You know that in the past, initiation science found entrance from time to time into the spiritual evolution of the earth. The initiation science that we need and which must see in modern science only the very beginning of a knowledge of man will find greater and greater opposition. You will need power, my dear friends, to combat the opposition to modern initiation. For even before the modern initiation, which is a re-establishment of intercourse with supersensible powers, came into its own in the last third of the 19th century, the opposing powers were at work, powers which bring about a condition of human culture and civilization largely unconscious, and whose aim really is utterly to root out modern initiation. Just think how popular it has become today to retort, quote, "This is my point of view," close quote, to everything that comes into the world in the way of knowledge. "This is my point of view," people say, without having ever developed it for themselves. Each one should estimate the value of his own point of view according to the position which he occupies in the world at the moment when he talks like this. And today what hurts and excites people most of all is speaking of a higher knowledge to which man has to develop and evolve. In the last third of the 19th century, when the possibility of the attainment of modern initiation set in, the opposing powers were even then already at work, and they were powers whose aim above all else was to bring about a great equalization, a leveling among men. One could name many men in whom this opposition to modern initiation worked. Do you think, my dear friends, that words spoken to you from out of the spirit of this initiation science could sound exactly the same as they sound on earth in reference to ordinary earth conditions? When I try to make it clear to you how human speech becomes something different when it is a question of developing language in relation to the nature of the spiritual world, I think you will not misunderstand me when I say the following. I myself shall never fail to recognize the great significance of Rousseau from a purely earthly standpoint. And if I were to speak from such a standpoint, it would be to give all the honor and appreciation and good criticism to him that others give. But if I had to attempt to clothe in earth words what initiation knowledge reveals in reference to Rousseau, then this is what I must say. Rousseau, with his tendency to equalize everything, to reduce everything to a dead level, appears to initiation science in the role of modern culture's, quote, babbler-in-chief, close quote, together with many other companions. That one may, from an earthly standpoint, speak of a man as being a great mind or a great personality, and yet from the standpoint of initiation speak of a man like Rousseau as the babbler-in-chief of modern spiritual life, is something that humanity, naturally, will not accept offhand. Modern initiation science must know the heavens and the earth and describe the mutual rhythm between the two before a real knowledge of man can be gained. It is only by the harmonizing of what is said from the one side and the other that a real knowledge of man can be developed. For this true knowledge of man must be built up upon that on which the ancient initiates built, the ex Deo nascimur, from God we are born. All memory must be built up upon what we may meet with when we look out into the universe, where Christ is our leader, although we are unconscious of it. But we must bring him ever more and more into consciousness, so that we recognize that which is in the world, of which death is the characteristic, to be under the leadership of the Christ, and know that with the Christ we live in a world of death, in Christo morimur, in Christ we die. But through this we know that with the Christ we sink into the grave of earth life, know that with him the resurrection takes place and the sending of the Spirit, per spiritum sanctum revivissimus, through the Holy Spirit we live again. This per spiritum sanctum revivissimus must above all be sought for by the modern initiate. When you think about this and compare it with the conviction today that has arisen as a result of science, you will realize that there will be the most terrible opposition, an opposition of which you perhaps today can form no possible idea. It will come to the point of expressing itself in deeds and in the tendency to make the spread of initiation science impossible. When I speak in a restricted circle like this, what I want to place in your hearts and souls is this: I want to awaken power through the descriptions acquired from modern initiation science, so that there may really be some few men who have come to the right poise between what is striving to pour into the world from the spiritual world and what from the world strives to make impossible, namely this penetration of spirituality into earthly life. This is what I wanted to point out in a narrow circle like this. There has been opportunity in the public lectures, which to my great satisfaction we have had in Oxford, to indicate the more external side. And so in this narrow circle it is the more esoteric side that has been considered. But it must sound paradoxical, for the language of the spiritual world is so different from earthly language. With labor and with power, one must bring into earthly language what really should be expressed differently, bring it into earthly speech, because it must be understood. Many things may be very startling when they appear before us as the simple, direct narrative of the spiritual worlds. While I wanted thus to characterize for you the motif underlying this lecture, I want also to express the deep satisfaction I have had at being able to speak to you again here in London. It is always a satisfaction to me. As I have already said, we are so very seldom together here. But all that we may plant in our hearts and souls in such rare meetings, the seeds of a communion in hearts and souls all over the world, which there should always be among anthroposophists, that is the underlying note of today's lecture. Let us make such meetings the stimulus to that intimate communion which binds all our hearts and souls together. And in this sense, let me say, may we remain in such communion, my dear friends, even though we separate and are far apart. The end of Lecture 3.